Well, we're going to talk now about new currencies. And I'm going to start with the assertion that there have been more new currencies created in the past 10 years than existed in all of history. And we're going to see even more created going forward. And in the currency part, we're talking about anything that can be exchanged for value, which is what the definition is. Now, the area, this is, I think, really important for a number of reasons. One is, Jeff was saying, there's huge profit pools associated with banking, which have a lot to do with the efficiencies and inefficiencies of different kinds of currency. The other thing is that if you look at the global economy on a purchasing power parity basis, it's about 55 trillion. Our estimates are that something like 10% of that is out chasing demand. And when I say chasing demand, I mean things like advertising, inside sales forces, promotional activities. To give you an idea, the United States, with a $13 trillion economy, we've got about $1 trillion chasing demand. That's about 80% of the size of the economy of India. So our marketing budget is essentially India's economy. When you think of it that way, and you say, okay, if we have new currencies, just for example, in one teeny area of OfferPal, which is a fast-growing point-based system on Facebook, so I can, you know, I can give you points, and I take a survey, I earn points, I give them to Jeff, he can turn it into either money or a physical good or a information good. It's growing very quickly. The point system alone allows for more targeting of that $1 trillion down to, okay, I can do a stimulus response. I have a whole new currency. That currency can get translated into money. It can get translated into things. But is available and allowable within Facebook in terms of new currency of attention, if you will. So I think everybody on the panel thinks this is a big thing. I'm going to ask them to stay to 5 minutes each. And so if I'm obnoxious, that's what they pay me for.
Points.
Points.
Capable.
Yeah, Clippers are points.
You believe it?
Yeah.
She's the reputation. Can't trade that.
All right, and so we're going to start off with Jim, who's going to talk about really the currency of the organization.
Great. And we have mics.
Yeah, we have mics.
Dude, I didn't know that. All right, 5 minutes. So, wow. You know, I wish I had slides like yours, and so I'm going to have to draw in the air because I don't. And so, first of all, I want to point out, just apropos of cell phone networks versus computer networks, that kind of interestingly, cell phone networks are much more advanced than computer networks right now in being almost banks, in the sense that you can do payment on them, you can do saving, they do risk management, they do pooling, they do a lot of the financial functions on those networks already. And so I just think that's an interesting thing to sort of bracket somewhere, that there already is, in a sense, a banking system that's bigger than the conventional banking system and that includes most of the third world. And I think that's where some of the practical excitement about doing things in the rest of the world comes, is from that tremendous growth and ubiquity of the cell phone networks. Second thing I want to talk about is that we've had a lot of discussion here today about self-forming networks and sort of groups and how valuable that is. And we also had a little discussion here about pattern languages. And I've gotten quite interested lately in the pattern languages that are inside games. And in a rudimentary way, think computer games. Think Halo. Think the games that our kids play. Think Pokemon or whatever the current one is. But it's very interesting to think about what are the rule sets, what are the game rules that are more and less productive for getting people to work together. And it's sort of David Johnson's interest and David Reed as well. We were talking about this just briefly a second ago. So I think when we think about platforms, cloud platforms for the future, one of the best ways to think about them is that they are platforms for people to interact in that have implicit and explicit rule sets that essentially define games. And I think some of the unifying theme of the whole Law Lab experience here is seeing that the malleability, the plasticity of the cloud platform and its ubiquity allows you to build pretty big games pretty easily and to play with the rules a lot, and in many cases to let people play themselves with those rules and experiment with them. And I think that, you know, that therefore is part of what we're doing in cloud law with the platform that we're building, is we're building a platform that allows for identity, it allows for permissions, it allows for those sort of things. But I think for me, most interestingly, it allows for feedback games, games that score things, games that count things. You know, you can instrument anything on a platform. You can instrument clicks, you can instrument, you know, reading time, you can instrument all sorts of things. And then you can design games that give people scores. Those points then become, in various ways, reputation points. They may become tradable and so forth. And is that my time? 2 minutes. All right. Okay, if you agree that clouds in the at the experience level are well seen as games, okay, the other piece of it, and this is the piece that we were talking about earlier as we thought about this presentation, is those platforms can be connected to the world in various ways and can be measuring other things. I mean, they can be measuring health behavior, they can be measuring my eating habits, they can be measuring how far I walk, they can be measuring actual physical transactions, and it's at that point where the measurement sort of meets the world and then can get summed up into games and then affect behavior that you begin to have a sort of generalized notion of a currency system. I think that's about right. That's where I think you begin to see something, you know, really powerful. I mean, one powerful thing is we can have different kinds of exchanges and different kinds of things on the cloud platform that are sort of conventionally defined currency systems. But it gets really powerful if you begin to be able to trade behavior and trade, you know, health behaviors. I'm done. Thanks.
All right.
I'm sorry, sir.
Right today. All right. Julius Dacagnani's going to talk about currency and property.
Okay. In a sense, we started this project as trying to demystify the wealth of nations, meaning how do we grow the wealth of nations in developing countries where, you know, we have given so much and AIDS and everything else, but then they are not sustainable. So what we came up with is the fact that if you look at cloud computing, at least personally, I believe it could be equally empowering as the mobile device when you look at what it has done for the developing world. So therefore, you think about mobile cloud computing. So Sandy and David talk about smart sensor and, you know, how we can enable all of those things, not just the cell phone, but the, you know, the sensors that can sense, capture, transmit, price instantaneously, and then be able to grant value to the owner. So underlying all of this, you know, is the property right, obviously, which in most developing countries is very minimal. And we believe if you start an e-registry where you have every asset owner register their asset, you know, be it goats or cows or land, and, you know, because their base of assets is totally different from what the Western culture knows. So in a sense, if we capture all of that, you know, into the mobile cloud, and we're able to actually look at an economic model that look at all the variables and then come out with what I would call the digital currency that now becomes very apparent to the rest of the world. It's not, you know, it would be a layer between the Western world cash trading, but then a little higher than the cultural trading. So you have a middle layer that takes the Western culture, but at the same time, take the nuances of the local culture to come up with, you know, some unified index that becomes, you know, a currency in a sense. So using that and then looking at the, you know, I call it the information exchange, which I consider to be even more critical. If you can build information exchange, you know, from the cloud, now you have an empowering entrepreneurial platform where people can go in there, do different things, start trading local, you know, local commodities, you know, on a local basis, as opposed to doing it at, you know, Chicago Stock Exchange. There's nothing preventing them from doing that. And all of that we can do on the mobile device and, you know, on a wireless capability. And doing most of those, and, you know, you get to a point where both the financial institutions and some of the other businesses, private sector, you know, gains from it, and by so doing, you are empowering them, and most especially the mobile carriers. Now you are creating a platform for data revenue that they never had before. So this morning, when we talk about, you know, why, you know, why cloud computing and what was the value of cloud computing, so I see it as an empowering tool, an empowering capability for developing economies as well as, you know, some of the big businesses, especially in the mobile device sector. So I can talk more about that, but that's kind of the essence of it in, you know, in the sense that we are creating new digital currency that will make, you know, developing economies far more apparent to the rest of the world. Hopefully be able to participate in the global economic growth.
So new currencies from the way people interact and their behaviors and capabilities, new currencies that link developing to developing.
Absolutely.
And makes it more efficient as well as connected.
Correct.
And then
currency that talks about currencies in general. Well, what I'm working on is what we call the meta currency. And the idea that we have is basically to do to liquefy currency itself. In the way value is liquefied by the creation of one currency, we need to liquefy the creation of currencies itself. And I think the way you spoke about that at the very beginning, David, that liquefaction factor is really a key thing. And so, you know, the why of this is kind of obvious, the current collapse. But I think there's a key, another way of looking at the why of it that gives some credit to the Clutrain Manifesto and the notion of markets as conversation, and also what David Johnson was saying earlier about conversations as being crucial. And that is that what do you say in a marketplace, and what language are you speaking, and what expressive capacity do you have? And by you, I mean actually the social organism, not just the individuals inside the marketplace. And so what I think the metacurrency platform does for us is it creates a new expressive capacity. And it's a capacity to create these new currencies. So how do we do this? The idea is to do something that we're all pretty much familiar with, which is create an edge-based network that's a group-forming network. Thanks again, David. And the way we do that is by having a game specification language or a currency specification language that's generalized in the same way that HTML is generalized and allows us to specify resources on the internet. And then you also have to have a transport, an open transport mechanism, the same way that HTTP gives us a way of transporting those resources once specified. And that's basically the heart of it. So that's what we're working on. We've got something called XGFL, which is the Extensible Game Format Language, which allows you to specify players and rule sets. And then we have the metacurrency protocol, which allows you to actually make plays in those games, again, using the game metaphor. And then underlying all of that, you have to have an open data platform that allows you to keep the data in a distributed fashion. So we have some ideas on how you do that as well. That's very similar to Git, if any of you are familiar with the with Git as holding the core of Linux. It's a version control system that allows you to have signed transactions all the way back to the beginning so that anybody can hold their own data. It's not something that needs to be centralized behind some firewall, that the integrity of the data is intrinsic in the data itself. So there's my attempt to get this out in 5 minutes.
Perfect. Two and a half. Well done. Okay. Well, I have some questions, but before jumping in, do folks have questions for our panelists?
I do, actually.
Go.
I'm curious about the potential intersection of that. You know, what a new currency is, it would be great to have an example, and maybe even the question of whether the metacurrencies apply to the currencies of local exchange. You know, there's sort of a unitary notion of currency, which is currencies are just numbers that quantify something and they get traded, so they establish a value and they get this mystical property, right? But I have the sense from what you're saying is that there might be other forms of currency that are not just numeric quantities of shekels or something, but in fact have some slightly other rules, and I'm not quite sure what a simple extension of currency would look like.
Well, I can pop a few examples of that. I mean, when we look at...
We discussed this for about an hour.
One example would help.
Okay, so it depends on what realm you're talking about, because there are currencies in the realm of tradable wealth, and those end up being the kinds of things you're talking about. That's what we're most familiar with. But there are currencies in the realm of what is not tradable but is measurable, and that is stuff like your reputation. So reputation points on eBay are an example of what I would call a currency. It's a formal system, a formal set of game of players in a game who are creating a token space and actually making plays that change that token space to be able to build wealth with each other in a different way. And so the success of eBay, I think, is built upon the fact that you have tradable wealth currency, the dollars, and a reputation system, which is, I would call, a currency.
And you can't.
It's not a trade.
You can't directly give somebody three reputation.
No, and
just yep. to go, because there's a concept of complementary currencies. Are you familiar with that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so you can have, and one is like a heavy fiat currency, or, and the way I tend to think of it, I'm not sure this is an accurate way, but one is sort of assuming a zero-sum relationship versus a cooperative game. Mm-hmm. And so a zero-sum is, in effect, with a fiat currency is something that you, say, a gold florin is an example of that, because it has intrinsic value, you trade across boundaries, which you assume the other party may defect. So it has, and so, whereas the other set of currencies encourage interaction and social cooperation. And so you have a different set of goals to achieve in the two different currencies, and they can complement each other. And part of that, I guess, is that when you think of a currency system as a way of accrediting, as accrediting and rewarding different kinds of behaviors in the most abstract sense. Would you agree with that? Or
we can go with that for now.
So I have a question on John's question. So,
okay.
So if you took a coin, right, and I gave you a coin, right, the zero sum right. some case, why is that not part of the cooperation example? Let me qualify that, because the presumption is that coin is actually real, right? It's I'm giving it to you, and I'm saying this coin really is what it is, and you receive it, and if you find out it's not what it is, my reputation, then you actually didn't have the money. My reputation is affected. Our relationship is impacted. So it's kind of implied, right, by the presumption that the currency really holds its.
Well, that's just what I think is what's fascinating as things become all zero and one. I mean, because in traditional, and Joel Goodman jumped in on that. But
I used to. Now this is this goes back a long time, but
15 books.
I used to define money, same as currency, as its value that Larry Ellison would take from Bill Gates. Because they wouldn't take anything else between each other. They hated each other's guts, but they would take each other's money, yeah. right? And right. and that's a really important distinction, because it has to be an exchange between people who otherwise agree on nothing.
But okay, so
it's a fiat currency. It's a different kind of currency.
Yeah, let me just add one thing. I think that's part of it, and actually, most of what we are describing. Be it in eBay reputation or my points or whatever it may be. To me, those are indices. They are local currencies. And when you sum those up as variables that you put into the economic model, then you produce a common denominator factor, which then becomes the tradable currency. Yeah. So in effect, let me, you know, maybe before I give an example, one of the things we've been talking about is my health. You know, my health condition could be a currency, okay? But sure, you know, maybe that's true. But I cannot trade my health for yours. You know, that's not doable. However, if I go to the bank and I build a risk model that says, okay, Julius heavy net worth this month, on, and I go back to ask for a loan. Obviously, my interest rate may be less than somebody, you know, Julius, you know, high risk and this and that because of his health. So those, to me, are variables and indices you throw into that economic model to be able to come up with a higher, far more reaching, you know, index or unifying currency that then becomes available.
And I think
so I understand that. If you take the health example, it's actually sure. a pretty good one. Then you can't directly trade it, but in a local region, for example, your health is implicitly affected by other people's health around you.
Correct.
So you could collectively act to improve each other's health.
Exactly.
That's correct.
Because you can make it visible.
That would create more of that health care.
Because you can make it visible, and you've got basically a playing form, just like the web makes all this information visible to us. If we have these abstract format in which we can play games together, then all of a sudden we can make visible these variables that build social well-being. And then we can trade on it, and we can do other things.
And you can also aggregate, you know, just like a small business does. You can, you can insure my family, don't insure me.
Same thing you do by investing.
Another example, without the exchange factor, so you're not exchanging value.
I don't think that's necessary, and I think actually one of the things that you were pointing out earlier about money is the thing that you can trade between two people who want to kill each other. That actually, to implement that kind of a monetary system is extremely expensive, and for people who actually don't hate each other, it might be much less expensive to create a different form and medium of exchange than that one.
Bernard Vaccari talks about money. That's why you have a complementary currency, because you have those situations.
Well, you don't just have a complementary currency. You have a whole range of currencies to deal with all of the different types of organismic relationships that we have as social organisms through all the different layers.
But you can trade some. I mean, you can trade frequent flyer miles, which are limited. They're hard to redeem as money. In fact, they try to make it very difficult. And certainly you can't redeem them. In the old days, when you could only redeem them for flights, if the airline goes out of business,
but that's because those currencies were designed to implement to incentivize one flow, which is loyalty. It's a loyalty currency, not a tradable wealth currency, which is the other side.
And one of the
we're very excited about this.
it is hard, but I think it's profound, and it started with your comments really at lunch. He was using currency in a very broad way, and we couldn't understand it, and we had to sort of tease it out for a bit. And I think part of the way I'm thinking about it, and I preface to Joel as well, is that in any transaction, there's an element that requires trust, and then there's an element that you do that's kind of above trust or doesn't require trust. And to me, the way I think about it is that in a sense, there's two dimensions of currency. There's currency that's related to fungibility and requires no trust. Okay, it's the kind you're talking about. Yeah. There's another kind of currency, and you could also think about it as signaling or credit or something like that, that essentially, it's not that it doesn't require trust, it's a substitute for trust. Okay, it's a substitute for personal trust. So if Bill Gates and Larry Ellison are doing a deal, as opposed to buying and selling something, they're doing a deal, then they've got people doing due diligence, they've got a lot of other things going on there that are a substitute for trust, but they're not quite the same thing as the tangible asset being exchanged. And so concrete example of this is I use this thing logo tournament. You know what this is? You can buy a logo for $200 to $500 from anywhere in the, you know, from a community. And
my painful
unbelievable.
Reputation points down for the
In
the future, we actually do that.
Quickly on logo tournament, in logo tournament, people compete to make a logo for you, and they're artists from all over the world, and you pay them between $200 and $500. You essentially set a bounty, and the thing is really neat because they can see each other's designs, they can hear your conversations with everybody or see it, and so the things co-evolve very rapidly. It takes about a week for you to get a sort of amazing set of designers doing amazing stuff. And what's interesting is it's winner take all for the financial part of it. Like, I'm only going to buy one logo, okay? But the system also has in it a system of points around first place, second place, third place, and honorable mention if I took them into the finals, okay? And those things are displayed on their profiles. And if you think about it, that's part of what keeps losers in the game, right, who aren't making money each time. But they are building their rep, and they're building their, you know, they're building a lot of value there. Now, it's not directly exchangeable, but it's certainly, you know, it does substitute for trust. Like, when you're on the game, you look at those ratings, and you go, wow, this guy's got a lot of awards here, and you take them seriously.
And so if you imagine, if you take that actual functionality, whatever those badges are, that say you've gotten so-and-so first places and second places, and you actually have a currency service provider that specializes in creating that and coming up with a pattern language that's a really good one for that, and you've got a platform, a metacurrency platform for creating that and then making those transactions and actually making the plays in the game, then I could grab that and insert that into my website if I was not doing logo design, but I was doing something else. And then there could be many, many other players who are taking that currency pattern and plug it into what they need. And that's creating an edge-based network around this game playing, this currency stuff.
And then we imagine extending that.
There's perhaps a more compelling example. I'm puzzling about Julius's thing. I mean, imagine that I'm a remote guy who is dealing with a country where there's a lot of local food production, right? They're currently, the only way I can imagine reifying that value is to say, you know, for me, is to say, let's set up an export. Let him produce food for the United States. The United States is a great country. And then we are, right? We'll take this thing. But the other possibility is sort of a multi-party play,
yes,
where I basically say, the food is actually best used there,
yep,
to feed some people,
yes,
who will then do something. Right. And I can orchestrate that remotely. That becomes a cloud if I can see into it.
Exactly.
I can say, oh, there's a collection of resources that let me put together something that I know eventually produces an asset that is useful.
Mm-hmm.
And so by creating a reified digital economy of the stuff that's there, which requires creating currencies you can only spend locally.
Yes. Exactly. And so, I mean,
you avoid the bug of
exactly
having it traded on the Merck, where you say, "Oh yes, at the end of the day, you have to deliver, you know, corn futures from this place."
That and that's an interesting kind of new liquidity.
An interesting example of that in Japan, where if my grandfather went out and helped Eric's grandfather with the harvest, then Eric's grandfather gave my grandfather a ribbon with some writing on it. I hang it in my barn. And then my grandson might take that and go to Eric's grandson and say, you have to help me with my harvest.
No, I'm kidding.
And that's that could be 120 years.
Talk about store of value. No, I mean, seriously, because one of the things that this allows us to do is actually decouple the three functions of money you said before. Because actually, our monetary system couples them together, and they're contradictory. Because if you want to store value and you want to have a medium of exchange, do the same thing. Those are contradictory functions. Because you want to sit on your money, but actually you want the money to move. And so they're contradictory. And so when we have multiple venues in which to hold the different functions of money by having this edge-based network, I think then we can actually achieve some of those things by creatively having that kind of thing you just mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, but the beauty of having it transferable and tradable is the fact that you can create secondary markets for business, which we don't have today. You don't have a secondary market for goods. Nobody cares. But if we can dollarize that, then you can start looking at, okay, maybe I need a secondary market for cows in Nigeria or in Ghana or wherever.
Right.
So those are the type of things.
Yeah. I mean, that guarantee wasn't earning any interest while sitting in the barn.
Exactly.
But it wasn't losing any value either.
The question I'd like to come back to then is what if there are no underlying assets, and there's no, and as we recognize where money's going now, and it is zeros and ones, and it's not secured by gold or anything, then what are the social signals, the social interactions that make it possible, say, for Japan to have something stored value to last that long? I mean, what are the networks of trust and reciprocity or something that enable that to be? Because, I mean, we talk about doing design a bank of the future.
But can I stop you for a minute? Gold has no value. That's not
I was going to say.
I think it was perceived to have a value at some point, and it was backed by a treasury that was created liquidity around it. It may have been a fiction at the time,
perceived
to be scarce and not manipulable. And that's why the Mother Teresa coin is still used in the Middle East, because it was 1758, but it was minted with a very high degree. But if that moves away, then what's the equivalent in a digital?
I think it's information. I think it's intellectual property.
There's the information aspect, but then there has to be a medium of delivery of that information. And at least when you look at the rest of the world, I see that as a mobile platform. So maybe you create a mobile currency, because if you are in the middle of nowhere in Ghana, you have a mobile device. If you are in the middle of nowhere in South Africa, you have one. If you are in America, you have one. So there has to be a way where we can universally transfer and value that currency.
But is Mark really sort of saying value it? I mean, the mark, you know, what we call marking to market or whatever, which is a fiction too. But basically, being able to audit that it is real according to the rules of the game.
That's what it is. I mean, the answer is that it's the same as it always was. It's just the answer is it's what we agree to. But if we learn that if we gain the capacity to know what it is we're agreeing to, rather than holding that implicitly, was what is going on with gold. That's
and to change it. Well,
they'll be included in the game. The enforcement mechanisms will be there.
It goes back to Oliver's thing about repeatability and stuff like that.
Yeah,
right?
Repeatable
games.
Exclusion.
You and I are going to have lots of interactions, and therefore we've decided overall we like this game.
But what if it's a one-time game? It's just an exchange.
It's actually what happens with currency is over time they degrade, just like information over time becomes obsolete. So your currency, your dollar of 1950 bought a lot more than a dollar does today, but actually the goods were different, the qualities were different, and just like we know more today than we did in 1950.
I'm not talking about the value of a currency, I'm talking about proliferation of currencies to the point of the information costs and transaction costs.
Yeah, but to your
whether
point.
Whether or not to accept this petty payment are too high relative to the value of the
yeah, I think to your point, that's the key issue there. The key issue will be the relativity of the currency. Yeah. If you have a relative value, then you know that can be consistent. I mean, it doesn't have to be consistent, it can fluctuate, but there will always be some relativity, therefore you can price it.
I think it evolves.
No, but wait,
Airline frequent flyer miles started in separate games, like you know, SNH green stamps or whatever. I mean, people build these different games, they last a while, but if they're gonna in the airline market, they kinda had to, I think, for a bunch of sort of selection factors. They had to begin to make them tradable and fungible, and now with American Express, you can do all sorts of trading with those things.
I want to ask an experiment, by the way, in Germany in the 20s after the First World War and the huge inflation, where they backed their currency with land, all the land in the country. It didn't last very long, but it ended inflation. And it was back. I mean, if you think about that, you're backing your currency with all the farmland, anything the government owns, and then they tax the government 5% on all those holdings in order to support the currency. And it ended that inflation.
But the reason why we went from the gold, where we dropped the gold standard, is because actually what we want to do is build our productive capacity. And if you have a currency that's supposed to allow us to exchange and work, and our productive capacity grows, the amount of currency around has to match our productive capacity. And so, if you lock it to anything like land or gold or anything scarce, you will lock down your productive capacity. And so, the question is actually, how do we turn it around and have currency work in support of increasing our productive capacity? And I think, to me, that's an answer to your question about currency overload. Is that if we start to think about it as Europe, and you know we have 12 currencies we have to trade between, you know this is going to be a huge problem. But if currencies rather are the things that make visible the social organism and the flows in the social organism, it's going to be sort of obvious, and we're going to love it. It's like right now we actually already use many more things that we think of as currency that are currencies, but that we don't think of them. Like nobody is confused by grades and credits and degrees. But that is actually one of these incentive flow systems that is a currency and could be developed much better, right? You know, they actually have problems. But you don't confuse that with your dollars, nor the coupons that you go down. You don't confuse those, nor the postage stamps. I think it'll be really actually very apparent to us. We'll gain a facility in that expressive capacity.
So these aren't abstract currencies. These are actually sort of directly tangible to actions that you as a player in
absolutely
life get to take. So, you know, I need one of those tickets to, it's almost like a ration ticket. It's like, I need
that's
a
one of them
to buy a gallon of gas.
Yep.
Right?
Did this picture worry Dave? Are you convinced by the arguments?
Cool.
If I could just throw in a question of everything we talked about, and there's still one question in my mind. We talked about the cloud law, and you know, we just talked about currency, we talked about architecture, we talked about capability. I still believe, you know, based on what we just talked about for developing countries, I think, you know, this is a key enabler for transparency, accountability, you know, however, the question still remains, how do we enforce the law? And that's one thing I haven't had any.
How do we do what?
How do we enforce the law, you know, of the cloud? That's one thing I haven't had addressed yet.
Well, one of the things that I was giving some thought on is that if you have member networks and you're a member network and you're waiting to be certified in that network, then they know who you are, and they're creating value in that network, you're being excluded from that network, then is a real penalty.
That's the main one.
And yeah. So it's an exclusion function, and that's why I come back to identities and then being able to root it, and they have a root identity, so the person can't come back again. But it's exorcism.
That's actually the most powerful thing.
You would have to process. I mean, do you have?
Well, you say that, but how do we know that?
No. It wouldn't necessarily be the case. You can't enforce that. In fact, the point about that is that removing somebody from your circle, there's nothing they can do to put themselves back in. Zero.
No. But if they're determined to make a violation and you have a due process of making that determination, then you remove them.
But the opposite is true in the system we have. Can you think of being removed from, say, the dollar? So you're excluded from using the dollar.
Well, people certainly experience that when their credit card stops working, right? And because their credit rating was no good, or because they're not considered to be employable for various reasons. They I mean, in fact, I think people's major experience of life is hunting for scarce dollars.
And that's... This talks about, like, counterparty risk, right? And we've seen just now that the systematic risk you can take on if you don't have a way of monitoring your counterparty risk. And if you remove someone from a circle, that'll have repercussions. Can they not fulfill their obligations in the currency that circle is built on? How will that follow through throughout the rest of your systems? It could be really dangerous.
Sure. That's a very good point. So, I mean, that's an interesting break on just wanting to kick people out. That actually gives an answer to your question of how of due process.
Well, I mean, in the real world, we have bankruptcy laws and we have margin requirements and all. I mean, this is a whole field.
Right.
This.
Well, and it says on a dollar bill that you must take it, essentially.
Well,
it says right on there.
Legal tender laws are a whole other thing.
That's that's why I say it's the opposite of being excluded. You must take it. I mean, in payment for anything.
But it's a default currency. But John, I was also going to say, though, that your exclusion works until the mechanism of exclusion is captured by the people who should be excluded.
The Goldman Sachs problem.
I mean, there is that difficulty. It is non-trivial to keep that policed and in proper operation.
But again, I come down to I think there was designing mechanisms for checks and balances, mm-hmm. and creating. So when you can see it, when a party is trying to gain something, there's certain behaviors goes with that. For every measure, there's a countermeasure, and you can see behavior that comes in that. There's no perfect solution. But there's no fiat to say it can't be done, and you cannot be done reasonably well, and there are enough people who can game it and break it.
John Sciocco said something I think interesting earlier. He was trying to see if we all agreed to the notion that there will be more and more currencies.
Right.
And I think I certainly do agree with that. What I think is most exciting about this is it seems to me we're entering an era where it's practical. Because of the cloud platform, to play with this stuff, right? It's practical for us to set up big games. It's practical for us to build currencies.
But aren't games doing that now? I mean, you have
games,
already. So you've been guilds and reputations and everything else.
I mean, it's happening all over.
That's part of your resume.
But that's the exciting. I mean, we're in an amazing time here. If we are as gods and we need to act like one, we need to say, oh my God, what are we doing here? You know, how do we use this for?
If Eric could say a little more about the relationship between these currencies and agency, and whether something akin to a vote, a vote can be instantiated in such a way that people are enabled to act on behalf of a group by virtue of a currency that then can't etiquette is withdrawable or whatever.
Oh, I mean, yeah, because voting is simply a set of players and a game. So away you go. And in fact, actually what it does is it gives you a platform in which to invent new forms of voting. So we're not left with so many of the problems of the disenfranchised minority and so on. So I think agency, I mean, you use them as a tool, as a decision-making tool in your circles, just like you use money as a decision-making tool.
But
one thing I'd... platform support a withdrawable, I'm thinking of the square trade certificate.
The what?
I'm thinking of the square trade certificate on eBay, which was a token that substituted for trust, but that did so because it could be withdrawn if the provider of the token determined that you had done something not in accordance with their rules. So is there a mechanism here for me to give you a token but with a string attached that I can bring it back?
I don't see why you couldn't create, as one of your rule sets, here's the state of the game, right? I mean, because the protocol is very generalized in that there's a game board which has a state, and it can have as many variables in it as you want, and then there are all these different player classes, and what you do is you specify what are the plays that the player classes can make. When you've got that, one of the plays that you make is withdraw token, give token, you know, and who's a member or who's a umpire or who's whatever you have. That's all there is. So it's, I mean, we get to be sort of punt on all these questions because you get to do it.
Pricing and currencies? Do you think there could be currencies where the same thing is priced very differently? For example, would there be a currency where the person on the shop floor is paid more in that currency than the CEO? I'm just making it up, but
that's interesting. When you first asked the question, I don't think I understand the question fully, because when you first asked the question, what I was thinking about is how I would love to know the price of my shoes in CO2 emissions, in child labor, as well as dollars. And so there is something that's priced in a bunch of different currencies that I would love to see the price. But right now it's all collapsed into one price, which is clearly, you know, it breaks the law of requisite variety. We can't make full decisions because we don't have that. But so I don't know how you flip that around going in the other way of paying the employees.
Well, I'm just wondering if it's a different exchange rate. So let's say you have a currency based on manual labor.
Sure, it seems like it would work. I think Julius' speaks to this because he talks about the indexes of where you gather all these things together.
Right. I mean, you will have that. The only thing, again, it's all relative value. So if you price it in labor hours or whatever it may be, a CEO may not be interested in that. You know, so they won't be bothered. You let the rule of the market go.
Oh, yeah.
But somebody else may be interested in that even wants to pay more than, you know, let's say it's 100 labor hours. Somebody may want to pay 120 labor hours.
I've got actually a real-world example of this.
There's a problem.
Yeah. People might pay more for
that's
right.
You're bordering on the belief system.
That's the point.
Here's something that I was calling very interesting, which is, I don't know if you guys have followed the idea of virtual water. Kind of a little like cap and trade of CO2. The idea of virtual water is it's kind of a currency that basically reflects the local cost of water in a particular region, because water is highly variable in its presence in the world. Mm-hmm. And what you'd like to do is create an incentive that causes processes that use a lot of water to be done in places that have a lot of water, right? About vice versa, and you can trade that against transportation and other things. But it doesn't work if you convert that all down to dollars.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly.
Because it doesn't have a secondary factor in the process.
Yeah.
So there's a group of people focusing on this virtual water concept that basically requires that you provide a certain amount of virtual water, which is kind of a currency, as part of acquiring something that consumes water. And you could buy the virtual water for dollars, but the cost of virtual water where you are depends on where you are. Right?
Right. So
that's good.
And the thing is that, I mean, the ontology of currency is relative. So the thing is that because we don't have them articulated, we don't have each of the dimensions of preference, cost, externalities articulated, we haven't got any markers to clear them.
I have an example for a real world example that I actually know of for you about pricing things differently. So there's this thing called time dollars, in which you don't price, and that's the rule of the game. In that game, you cannot price it. Everybody's hours are the same. Now, and that's just what people agree to play who are playing that game agree to play. Now, a CEO of a Fortune 500 company will mow the lawn of his next door neighbor, an old lady, for one time dollar. which is 1 hour of his time, because it takes him 1 hour. Can you pay him anything to mow that lawn in federal dollars? He won't do it. So there's an example of...
So that's more like the Japanese example.
Right. Yeah. But the thing is that...
It works in a whole different way. And the neurophysiology of it is very different.
And what it actually does, too, is different, right? Instead of actually being about what dollars are about, it's about building community. So now this CEO is in relationship with this old lady who lives next to him. And that's what it's for.
John, can you just speak a little bit more to why the neurophysiology?
Well, I mean, there have been a lot of studies on how people build trust into the neuroeconomics and where you get oxytocin. You get your oxytocin hit, your serotonin hit, versus when you're doing something that is a part of empathy with someone, and so it actually is a whole different kind of reward structure. And if you're doing something that is accumulative and is more self-interested than other interests, and there is a different kind of, we've evolved different mechanisms in the brain for doing that and rewarding those structures. And those have been many experiments that's repeated.
I bet they haven't looked at the brains of traders, because
there's
a good trader friend of mine who actually described his marriage as a trade. He said, "Well, I'm long this woman." I was like, "What?"
Well, no, but there is something called they've done these automated experiments. They'll say they have they call it there are they're Mach 4. There's 20% of the population is that way. They tend to be surgeons and economists. And it is, it's probably genetic.
And traders,
you know, as it were.
Any other voice that you guys want to chime in here? Or Bill?
Quiet down at the end of the room.
I guess the one thought I was having was the persistence of the currencies as you move through. The intersection of the number of hypercurrencies. People have, there's got to be some limit to the number of currencies I can follow, even if I'm interested in several different facets. And then if I get a currency, say, an eBay reputation, is this going to be interoperable? Is it transferable to some other venue for reputation, for example? It may have its own
conversion rates. Accept your currency or not.
Banks used to issue currencies,
right.
You might have people might try and get out of the First National dollar and into the Bank America dollar because it's safer. And there were even early on, there were runs on the Fed. The different banks in the Fed, each of them issued dollars until people got used to a single system.
Anne-Marie, you're starting to say.
Yeah, the point about the eBay reputation, whether it's tradable, I think the bank member reading something that the bank is not,
they
the terms of use prohibit you from moving it around or using it elsewhere.
Very,
people
very
you to try to advertise yourself to eBay, five-star seller somewhere else.
Which is total madness. I mean, they should be doing exactly the opposite.
Right.
No. The reason they don't is because of the feedback mechanisms. Because you could inflate your reputation, you could take it off, and then sit there and go, well, I am 99%. And then people come back and go, and you go and do some bad behavior. And there's not necessarily a feedback mechanism set up, and they don't want to actually deal with anyone who's not within the exact same architecture doing the exact same metric that they're measuring.
So it's because the enforcement costs of the brand is too high.
So then that's one of the interesting things about putting this out into an open platform.
The other question is why eBay gets to make that decision as opposed to all the people who create the reputation ratings in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the whole thing, and that's one of the complexities of that mutual ownership, because of the reputation rating. It's not just you and eBay that owns that reputation rating. Yeah. It's now you, eBay, and the thousands of people who rated you.
Yeah, and so it should be.
All agree to their terms of use.
Exactly. And the attorney.
Slap
a bind.
Okay.
Oh, that's a good one.
Terms of use are game specifications, right?
Yeah.
Specified by one party.
A lot of the times, the majority of them are not actually enforced, considering how the majority of them are written. They're completely irrational.
Garrett?
So what legal...
Sorry. Garrett, I was just trying to get in here. You want to...
Can you identify regulatory barriers to your legal loans?
Actually, I would love a lot of help with that. It seems to me that because the, I mean, what are the regulatory barriers to having HTML and HTTP? There's nothing until you actually start putting up kiddie porn or something else, right? It depends on the content. But if because if you just have an open platform for creating rule sets, what can the law say? It can certainly say things about how you use and how you name particular rule sets. But it's weird to me about the law and how it does end up being about naming of something, often not even actually what it does. You can use the exact same function, algorithm, use a different name and the law will treat it differently. I think. It's been my experience that that's the case. And I'm sure the law will be grumpy about some things that some people try to do. Like there's rules, what the IRS requires anything that looks like barter points to be counted against taxes. Now, I don't know whether that's been tested constitutionally, and I think probably it is unconstitutional, that you're forced to use federal dollars and tax it at that rate. So there'll be lots of things that come up. But
I think that's perfectly constitutional.
Okay, maybe it is. I don't know.
Garrett, I was trying to get in. Garrett?
I come up with a very different different approach. You talk about value and you talk about systems of representation, currencies. What I find is interesting is that in former times we talked about citizenship, we talked about responsibility, we talked about the problem. About the system in Japan with this letter of recommendation. And I think it's an interesting shift that we start to have a very technical view upon all this help and support and responsibility and try to compute all this and to measure it and to make it, to bring it into the system, the national system. And I think this is also an interesting point that we lose all these old-fashioned systems of what religious or ethics has done. And we bring all this into a new currency. The currency is...
We had a talk last night about Asperger's syndrome, and Sandy was saying there's a dorm at MIT that requires everyone to have an Asperger's diagnosis, and they like it because they think, you know, this is a great way to live. You know, they sort of Asperger's liberation movement. You know, they're straightforward, you know, in a way that other people aren't. And,
so, I think we had that discussion. Yeah, I mean, I think the points you make are absolutely central to this whole piece because, to me, the underlying piece is to be able to build up our capacity to be more human, and if we're not or whatever, I mean, something that resonates with that, and that's why I keep talking about expressive capacity. It's about being able to speak a new language that allows the social organism to see itself and behave. And so at some level, have this kind of stuff in a new way. And I don't see how we can do it at the large scale without having formal systems like these currencies. But they're only in service of the richness of the stuff that you were talking about, our relationships with each other. And so it feels to me somewhat like it's one of those things that you have to step into the scary part to get through it. At least that's my hope, because if not, then what Sandy was talking about 1984 squared, we're going to have that.
Well, I think that's a perfect place to stop. One of the things I would say is in the mission of I think this group and the Berkman Center, at least my vote would be that more focus on currencies is something that would be very practical, because it runs from very specific issues of rights and reputation, things like that, that are already being discussed all the way through, I think, very philosophical ones about, you know, what is the nature of meaning and culture and value and so forth. And so you could, I mean, as a center, I think you could help us all, you know, by pushing on that.